Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening. Welcome to Yada Yawa. Happy Shabbat to those living in places where the sun has set on this beautiful Friday evening. For those of you living out there in the People's Republic of California, like Kirk, I know you have a ways to go, so this is pre-Shabbat for you. For those who are listening who are Yehudim, Jews, and Yisrael, and you are concerned that we are bringing this program to you on the Shabbat, I would encourage you to recognize that Shabbat is a verb and that Yahweh is very active in his appreciation and enjoyment of the Shabbat. The Shabbat was never a day to get tied up in knots with a thousand ways to do nothing, with more rules and regulations than any other day of the week. It was a day to celebrate our relationship with Yahweh, the God whose name you won't even say. And so Shabbat is a day to celebrate our relationship with Yahweh. It is not a day to do nothing. I'd like to begin our program this evening by condemning the leaders of three countries, plus the leaders of the international community. South Africa not learning its lesson from its condemnation of Israel as they brought a case to the World Court, which it should not have heard, and ended up exonerating Israel. They're now back at it, and once again, Republic of South Africa, which probably would not have emerged from the racial divide in that country, the apartheid, if it were not for Jews. They were the most aggressive, trying to liberate the Africans in that country, who have, by the way, made a mess of it. The country, in almost all ways, is inferior to what it was. That's not to say that apartheid is good. It's just that the way you went about dealing with it turned out to create a bigger mess than existed previously. But this time, there are two countries that have joined South Africa. They are Egypt and Turkey, which is a completely lost cause. And they are accusing Israel of genocide in Rafah. Think about that for a moment. The United Nations has finally recognized that what I brought to your attention about a month ago, that on some 60% of the death estimates in Gaza by the health department there, which is an arm of Hamas. They had deficient data to determine who it was, when it was, that was allegedly killed, or even who killed whom, or whether or not they were a combatant or not a combatant. And some 60% was grossly deficient data to make an intelligent conclusion. Well, they have subsequently said this week that and the UN has acknowledged that some 40% of the estimated fatalities in Gaza were exaggerated, and that rather than some 35,000, the actual number is closer to 25,000 Gazans who have died since Israel went in to hold Hamas and Muslims accountable for what they did on October 7th. Now, it is beyond just the fact that they've announced that, well, they exaggerated the numbers by almost 50%. What they're not telling you is that Israel so far has taken out about 15,000, maybe more, jihadists. So out of the 23,000 that the Hamas Health Department will say that were killed, some 13,000 to 14,000 of those were actually Hamas fighters. So they don't count. And Hamas was spectacular at blaming Jews for killing exaggerated numbers of people that Hamas themselves killed. And they are very good at killing their own. In fact, over the last 25 years, Muslims have killed far more Muslims than they have killed non-Muslims. The case in point was the blowing up of the hospital where Hamas Health Department blamed Jews for taking out the hospital, killing over 500 people when some 25 people died, and they were killed by a misfire of a Islamic Jihad rocket having nothing to do with Israel. So the number of potential non-combatants that have been killed in Gaza as a result of not only Muslims from Hamas terrorizing Jews, raping, murdering, plundering, mass murdering the Jews on October 7th, is that by retreating to Gaza and hiding among civilians, they're responsible for even the 10,000 that may have not been direct combatants, but gave birth to the combatants, raised the combatants, encouraged the combatants. And if you were to take 10,000 and divide that into 2.2 million Gazians, what you'd find is that the maximum number of non-combatants, even though they were enthusiastic supporters of what Gaza or what the Gazans did in Israel, would be half of 1%. Half of 1%, folks, ain't genocide. Not even remotely. But beyond that, there has never been a genocide where the genocidal party provided copious amounts of food for those that were supposedly the victims of genocide. Israel is, and the world is now providing 50% more food to Gaza than had been provided prior to the war. There is no situation of genocide where the country allegedly perpetrating the genocide is sacrificing its own sons and daughters to minimize civilian casualties. Israel could have bombed all of Gaza into oblivion and then could have flooded every tunnel and not lost a single soldier, not lost a single son or daughter. And yet, to minimize civilian casualties, Israel has gone in and fought hand-to-hand combat, eye-to-eye combat, sacrificing their own sons and daughters to try to protect Gazan Muslims. So for the International Court to hear a case of genocide against Israel under these circumstances is so ignorant, so irrational, so immoral, as to say that the United Nations really has no right to exist, has no right to make a statement about anybody for any reason. And this right on the heels of recognizing Palestinian statehood and rewarding the terrorist atrocities. The world's lost its moral compass. Part of that is, of course, because Muslims have no morals. And all you need to do is read the Quran, and you would know that to be a fact. And because progressives who are in bed with them now and promoting them have no morals. And so between the two, the world's in a very hellish position. And that brings us to setting dates. We read in Yashaya that there will be a harvest that will be directly associated with a treaty thinning Israel at the waist. And that agreement is obviously the so-called two-state solution. I would call it the final solution because it's very much like the agreement that Neville Chamberlain made with Adolf Hitler, where he gave Hitler the high ground of Czechoslovakia, and as a direct result of doing that, the world ended up in World War II. And this time, when lines are drawn and a official state is carved out of Israel to give to the Islamic terrorists masquerading as Palestinians, that is precisely what's going to happen. Israel's days are numbered from that moment. In fact, the world's precipice will fall right into the precipice of World War, just as happened in the Second World War, except this time the belligerents have nuclear weapons, and the consequence will be far more grievous. So really the question is, when will that happen? At this point, the only reason it hasn't happened is that as much as I dislike him for his coalition with the Haredim, and for many other reasons, because of Benjamin Netanyahu. The two others that are the leaders in his war cabinet would concede to a fake Assadian state, which destroys all hope for Israel. The only chance Israel has to survive at that point is Yahweh's direct intervention. So what's going to happen relative to that timing, the imposition of a Fakistinian, Palestinian state carved out of Israel with borders and with Israel no longer having the right to inspect the weapons that are imported into it or to protect itself from it? And the furthest I can see that being out would be into 2026, perhaps 2 years from now. And that's really the time left on this current government in Israel. And there's really no reason for it to dissolve itself because the parties all gain from it continuing between now and then. But that really is the will be the end of it. And so we need to be looking for a harvest to coincide with that. Over the past several years, three women that are part of the covenant family, with the most aggressive of those three in terms of the amount of research that was done, being Dee, the co-host of this program, but working with Jackie and to some degree my wife, and I think consulting with others, came to the conclusion that while everything we have said about Shavuot is true, that because it is a harvest, there's more to it. And also because it is a harvest, there is more to Teruah than we had previously conveyed, although everything we have said about Shavuot and Teruah have turned out to be true. But the realization is that Shavuot was, well, I think it was fulfilled by Dod in the sense that he benefited from being enriched and empowered by Yahweh on that day. The fact of the matter is, in terms of the primary fulfillment of Shavua, that didn't occur in 33 CE. In 33 CE, we have the primary fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim based upon the dress rehearsal exactly 2,000 years earlier with Abraham and Yitzhak as father and son. We have father and son fulfilling Pesach in 33 CE. It would be April 2nd, April 3rd, and April 4th in 33 CE in year 4000 Yom. And there's no question that Dod fulfilled Pesach with his Bashar corporal body, serving as the Pesach Eil, the Passover lamb, and his soul carrying our guilt, the guilt of every covenant member, into Sheol on the Shabbat of Matzah, and that he was released from Sheol and returned to his father on the morning of firstborn children.
Mm-hmm.
And firstborn children does have Yisharon as part of it, which is this tenfold empowerment and enrichment. And so, quite frankly, all five benefits of the covenant are fulfilled with Dod's fulfillment, father and son working together to fulfill Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. I want to pause here and just say that the recognition that Dod fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim is the single most important discovery in human history.
Yes.
Nothing is more important to the salvation of God's people, the reconciliation of God's people, the recognition of the truth behind the Torah and the Berit covenant of the prophets, than this recognition that father and son fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. It destroys everything associated with Christianity, everything associated with Judaism, and of course everything associated with Islam. Nothing more important than this recognition, because it also means that Dod is the returning king, is the Messiah, is the Son of God who is returning on Yom Kippurim in 2033. And that date, which is a Sunday, 6:22 p.m. as the sun sets in Jerusalem on October 2nd, year 6000 Yah, is the date that Yahweh returns with Dod, father and son, and the relationships are all reconciled. However, as I began this mission 2001 on Teruah, now 23 years, almost 23 years ago. At the time, I was an agnostic, and I had come to realize that Christianity was untrue. But just recognizing it's untrue and removing all of the myths that are so woven into our culture and our thought process is another thing altogether. And so you go through the realization that Christian New Testament's completely false. You even recognize there was no Jesus. It's a complete myth. And that when Dod you recognize is the one who fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, then the basis of Judaism, which was the false Messiah, Bar Kokhba, untrue. The myth of Jesus Christ being the Son of God and the Messiah, untrue. Unfortunately, in the Christian New Testament, there is this exceedingly false presentation of the one holiday that they celebrate among the seven Moed Mikrei of Yahweh, which is they call Pentecost, which is Shavuah. And over the last 4 or 5 years, I have gone into that account as it's presented in the books of Acts and just tore it to ribbons, where I have shown that not a single thing Shimon Kefesh, the man called Peter, said about that date was true. Nothing. Everything he said was a lie. And I've come to realize there's a reason why we read, even in the Christian New Testament, that the caricature known as Iesu Christu refers to him as Satan. He got everything wrong. And, you know, I had written four volumes proving that Paul was not only demon-possessed, but that he got everything wrong. But the fact is, Shavuot is not fulfilled. And the reason we know it's not fulfilled is because it is a harvest, and it is a harvest of standing grain.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a harvest of standing grain, there was no harvest of standing grain in 33 CE. Dode fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. Shavuot is yet unfulfilled. It is a harvest of standing grain. What is the single most symbolic item associated with Shavuot? When you think of Shavuot, what's the first thing you think about?
Two loaves of bread, right?
Yeah.
Waving those two loaves of bread to Yahweh.
Yeah.
You know what those two loaves of bread represent?
What?
Israel and Goyim.
Yeah.
This is the harvest of the covenant family, which is comprised of Israel and of Goyim.
Yay.
It's the covenant members. And they're probably fairly equal in number. That's why it's two loaves. And, you know, there was a period of time where, maybe until just recently, that I thought about this harvest as grossly inferior to Yom Kippur. And thinking of, you know, this is, we're just going to get the covenant family, you know, out of the way so they don't have to endure the time of Jacob's troubles. And then we come back as witnesses, Elia and myself, and we give them hell. I mean, we just lambast everybody, including Jews. I said, wake up, man. You got 3 years left. You know, I heard the other day through a friend that is speaking to Jews in Israel that are reading my books. And they're complaining in a way. They recognize there's nothing that they've ever seen anywhere close to these, but they're complaining away. So, you know, wouldn't it be better if you had some compassion for our situation, some awareness and some concern for our culture, and met us halfway in between and just stop screaming at us? No.
No.
You need to be screamed at. You know, one of the things that is obvious about Shavuot, and it's obvious about Kippurim, this is a damn bull on the menu.
Yep.
And there's a goat on the menu. The goat's Elia. I'm the damn bull.
Yep.
You know, and Yisrael, you wanted a damn bull. What's the first thing that you made during the Exodus?
Yes.
You made a bull.
Wow.
You wanted a bull, you got a bull.
For.
You asked for it. And then you told Yahweh you didn't want to hear directly from him. You wanted his message filtered through somebody. Yeah, you got it. Now coming through a bull. And I'm going to tell you, Yahweh thinks you stink. He thinks you've been embittered, you're contentious, you've been jerks. You've treated him like crap. You won't even say his name. You don't observe his called-out invitations to meet each year. You don't even know what they mean. You ignore the conditions and the benefits of his covenant. You're religious. After all he said to condemn your religiosity, you're still religious. You're still choosing leaders like you chose King Saul, Shaul. You still haven't recognized that Bar Kokhba, the son of the star, was a false messiah and you parade around under a flag with a star. You're obnoxious. I love you. God loves you, but you're obnoxious. You need to hear the truth, and it needs to hit you right between the eyes because you don't have much time left. And I'm going to tell you, God's not going to meet you halfway. You're either going to drop the politics and drop the religiosity, or it's over for you. You're part of the problem. So get over yourselves. So anyway, I was thinking that, well, you know, they're his people. Yahweh loves them. There's nothing that Yahweh's going to enjoy more than this family reunion.
Sure.
This return of and reconciliation of his people. And I thought, no, it's not the case. It's just not the case. And all you have to think is, think it through. This upcoming harvest, we'll talk about some dates here in a moment, of Shavuot. It's filled with Goyim and Yehudim, all equal in Yah's size. Every single one came to Yahweh by choice. They weren't compelled. Every single one took advantage of what Yahweh has provided. They considered his Torah. They considered his prophets. They considered what he was offering, what he was asking in return, and voluntarily, based upon the information he has made available over the past 3,500 years, chose to be part of his family, to respect him, to love him, to engage with him, to trust him. On the other hand, his irascible children, Yisrael, are going to wait till the last minute when there is no hope left apart from Yahweh, when the IDF and the politicians and the religious rabbis and everybody fails them, their backs are against the wall, and there is nothing left. And even at that point, you bring back the most credible of all the prophets in terms of boy, this guy, you didn't want to go against him. Elia. And Elia is going to say, listen to this guy, the damn bull.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to take signs in the sky. It's going to take Yahweh lifting up the Ark of the Covenant, taking these books that we've written and making them banners for people to read. And the two of us speaking to everybody that will listen with the power of Yahweh. And even then, Jews are so irascible, it's going to take everything that we can throw at it to finally get a remnant to say yes, and at the last minute. So what do you think? If you're Yahweh, and you laid it all out, Father and Son fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Makudim together for our benefit. They told us all about it. They've laid it all out. You know, one of the things that becomes obvious is this mission that we're part of here. It's woven all through the Torah, not just through the prophets. When you look at even the menu of what is going to be consumed on each of these dates, they speak of the people who are involved in their fulfillment. All the way through, Yahweh has brought this to the attention of his people so they would listen. And so there's going to be a harvest of the covenant family comprised of two loaves, Goyim and Yehudim. And it's going to occur on Shavuot. So which Shavuot? The time of Jacob's troubles is 10 years, 7 years, 3.5 years, and 10 days. All of those are correct answers. The reason it's 10 years is we go from October 7th, 2023, the day that everything changed forever for Israel, to October 7th, 2033, which is Sukkah, and you're 6,000 Yah. It's 10 years. It is likely that the thinning of Israel, as is explained in Yeshaya 17 and 18, making the country indefensible and precipitated a flood of jihadists at least 100-fold worse than what occurred on October 7th in 2023 of this past year, will occur in the year 2026. And the timing of giving Israel 7 years during the time of Jacob's trouble to get his act together, it means that there's a high likelihood that Shavuot is going to take place in that harvest of the covenant family on Shavuot in 2026. The dates are Friday, May 22nd. Now, Shavuot is a harvest of standing grain, barley. The winter crop of barley that becomes Abib at the first of Abib, setting the timing for Pesach, which means green and still growing, therefore receptive, is actually harvested in late April through late May. And so May 22nd falls into the timeline as to when barley would be harvested in Israel. And it is a grain harvest. And we'll wait and see how many Israelites and Yehudim and Goyim that are part of the covenant family that return to Yahweh based upon all God has provided, what he is offering and expecting in return on that date. But I think that is the most likely time is that we have 2 years. And I'm going to tell you, as the author of the Yada Yahwa series, which is now over 30 books, that's exactly the amount of time that I need to have them prepared to the point where I can do something that's important to me. It may not be important to anybody else, but it's important to me. I do not want to approach Yahwa for the first time, which I have asked of Yahweh that I could just sit in the back of the room, stand in the back of the room, and watch the covenant family be received by Yahweh and just enjoy that moment and the expression on God's face as it happens. I have asked that I not experience that with a job not well done. I think that after now 23 years of doing this, 6 and 7 days a week, between 10 and 14 hours a day, that I have given it my all. It isn't all done. And I do not want to go without the job being at least done to the best of our collective ability. I realize that Yahweh is supplying all the insights, that Yahweh has devoted the his seven spirits to this project. But nonetheless, Yahweh works through people, and he expects us to make our contribution. And it's important for me that we complete Goddamn Religion. I'm in volume 5 now. That we rewrite Questioning Paul as Twistianity. And it's a major rewrite because I must write Yosha out of it and Dode into it. And it has to be a chapter that explains Dode, and it must be a chapter that explains how it was possible for this myth to have replaced Dode, and how it happened that the only eyewitnesses for what happened were written 1,000 years before it was fulfilled by Dode himself. And so I need to write that in volume 1, and I intend to do so. But there's, 6 months or more of work getting that done. I must complete volume 3 of Coming Home. And now I am compelled to write volume 4 of Coming Home. And volume 4 of Coming Home is going to do a comprehensive presentation of what Dee began here in showing all of the evidence in support of Shavua being the next harvest, and then Teruah, and we'll talk about the fulfillment of Teruah in a moment. But there's an entire volume that walks you through all of that process and how we know what's going to happen and when it's going to occur. Mm-hmm. So I think we as a covenant family need to do everything we can, and I believe that at this point my health stays good and there are no major distractions, that those things I've just talked about, completing Coming Home 3, writing Coming Home 4 about all of these events, cleaning up, questioning Paul as Twistianity, 4 volumes, and then finishing this volume 5 of Goddamn Religion, and then doing an edit of some of the ongoing comments related to the fulfillment of Shavua and Teruah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's 2 years' work.
Sounds
so I think we can get it done. I think we can get it done, and that's important. It's, you know, it's just like Moshe in a way. You don't want to step aside until you've done the job the best that you can possibly do it. And then you've got all eternity to celebrate with the satisfaction you gave it your best. That's where we are. And this is a team effort. As a matter of fact, one of the things that is really important to share, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about Shavua, is that there are two ways to look at the role of teacher. And I feel like I am a covenant. I am a Torah teacher. I am
sure.
Someone who is here to teach Torah, to mm-hmm. provide insights that help us understand the prophets, to herald our King and Messiah's arrival and Dode. And mm-hmm. in that first role, which is Torah teacher, what you want is for those that you teach to be able to grow and learn and discover things on their own. Then you know that you have accomplished what Yahweh is seeking, which is to have a family that is capable of growing and learning and engaging and doing really high-quality work. And so it is far more rewarding to have the covenant family come to these conclusions and provide the evidence for them than it would have been to come to the realization, boy, you know, it's got to be Shavua. So I'm actually thrilled.
I'd like to interject on that also, is that we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for what you taught. So it's rewarding for us as students to be able to come to you and say, hey, teach, you've taught us all this groundwork, you've laid this foundation, and we were able to make this connection and bring it to you. I mean, it's rewarding for everyone involved.
I agree. I would also tell you that when you first approached this about a week ago, in fact, a week ago today, my response, because I was so involved in trying to finish the edit process for Goddamn Religion 4, which is done and available
right
now at Amazon, and available now on the site, and thank you very much, David, for getting it up so quickly. I'm actually very proud of Goddamn Religion 4. I think it is exceedingly well-written and powerful. I mean, I really
it's
put
incredible.
a lot of effort and energy into that book. That rather than read what Dee had sent me, I read the first few pages, and I said, you know, I think I know where the answer to this is. And it was in Observations, Volume 5,
mm-hmm.
all of it, from Zechariah and the predicting of the in the fourth chapter of who those two witnesses are going to be and how they're going to engage and the fact that they're associated with an olive tree, to the role that Dode's going to play as the high priest, which is in the next chapter, as Yosha as the high priest is axed, and Dode is given that role. That presentation, as well as the presentation of the Shavuah harvest, I think it's what, the 83rd Mizmor.
Yes.
As well as the entire presentation, because the beginning of the 89th isn't just this celebration of Dode as the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, and the returning king, but it also is about the herald who's going to bring that news to God's people.
Exactly.
It's all in Observations, Volume 5. All laid out there for us. I reread it and said, huh, that is much.
Yes, you did.
It's all there. And so that's going to be the harvest. Now, is there the possibility that the Shavuah harvest could be in 2029? I hope so. It would also be a Shabbat, a Friday, on May 18th in 2029. So my hope is that we have 3 years to promote this work aggressively. If not, we will be ready on May 22nd, a Friday, a Shabbat, in 2026. And there's more to just finishing those books. There's also the talkies. When I shared with you that my wife had created ones with graphic images, and Dee had created them with the words beneath what we were sharing as part of this program, both are infinitely more powerful.
Yes.
Than the things we've done previously. They are really powerful and do such a wonderful job of inviting people to read the books and speaking to the heart of both Yehudim and Yisraelites. And so there's a lot more talkies that need to be produced and distributed to get people's attention. So I think it's going to be...
The reason I did that originally was simply because Yahweh says, when you hear this in the air coming to you, a voice calling out, the talkies encapsulate that. They are a way to put it out in a quick manner in front of people on social media, coming through the air, a voice calling out, this is what we're doing this for. This is what we want people to hear is your voice. So
but
that's why...
Until 2 weeks ago, we had not done that.
No,
you are
I had started it like months ago, but it took forever for me to get it. I mean, it's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. It's very difficult to do, to take the voice of a program like this and make it part of a movie that has the right kind of graphics in support of it. But it is the power of the Ultimate Sermon on the Mount. That was when, the cornerstone, which is an exceedingly important part of all of this, the cornerstone, which is really the 89th Mizmor, it's also the cornerstone of Yahweh's house, the covenant family home on Mount Moriah. It was laid exactly 1,000 years before Father and Son fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. And it was 8 years after that cornerstone was laid that Solomon gave this speech and introduced to Yisrael the inevitability of the Nakri, which is the voice speaking to you at this moment. And it is an exceedingly clear, powerful prophecy about the future of God's people and what they needed to do to reconcile their relationship with our Father. And that cornerstone is a theme that runs through the Torah. There is this myth by mistranslation that Yahweh appeared to Moshe in a burning bush. That is not the case. Yahweh appeared to Moshe as a crag on the side of the mountain that was a fire. My name is Craig. It is this burning of Yahweh's light from Choreb, where the Torah was revealed, that Yahweh is using to call his people home. And it is that cornerstone that is so essential to recognizing what occurred in year 3000, in the middle of this time from the garden back to the garden, as Dode became the cornerstone of the house on Mount Moriah, exactly 1,000 years after Abraham and Yishak, as father and son, provided the dress rehearsal for Pesach, and Yahweh said, don't take the life of your beloved son, your only son. And then Yahweh fulfilling Pesach in exactly the same place, exactly 1,000 years, exactly 2,000 years later from that, but 1,000 years into the point that the cornerstone of the family home was laid on Mount Moriah, and 1,000 years from there to the actual fulfillment. And the eyewitness accounts are riveting, because in the 22nd and 88th Mizmor, Dode speaks in first person about specifically what's going to occur on the fulfillment of both Pesach and Matzah, as well as Bukurim. So there is no secret to any of this. It was all laid out for us. And then as we've been reading through the first five Mizmor, Dode explains that he is going to do this, and he's decided that he's going to do this, and how important it is for him to do this, and that Yahweh is supporting that decision. So it is very well attested. So Shavua is the next harvest. It is of standing grain. It is of Goyim and of Yisraelites who are part of the covenant family. And it is to remove them from the seven worst years of the time of Jacob's troubles, the thinning of Shar, of Yisrael at the waist. And it will commence as Israel is thinned by this two-state solution, where Israel is narrowed to a matter of just a few miles wide at the very place where some 70% of the population of Israel resides. It will be far more devastating than Neville Chamberlain's gift of Czechoslovakia to Adolf Hitler, and it will usher in a Third World War. Now let's speak to Teruah. Teruah is going to be fulfilled on in year 6000, just as Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, as the three spring feasts, were fulfilled in succession in year 4000, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah will be fulfilled as the three fall feasts in year 6000, Teruah is also a harvest. The harvest that is at in the fall in Israel is of olives. And the two witnesses are spoken of as branches of olives. We're told in Yeshayah that you're going to have two or three ripe olives from the uppermost branch, and three or four, or four to five olives from the branch that has been cut away. I'm happy to explain that. The uppermost branch has always been and will always be Yehuda. The branch that was cut away was Yisrael and the 10 tribes that were cut away from the collective of the entire kingdom under Dode and beginning under Solomon.
Makes sense.
And so it will be a multiple of seven. I don't know if it's 7,000, 70,000, or 77,000 between Yisraelites and Yehudim, who will be harvested on Teruah in 2033, 10 days before the Yom Kippurim return. And you might say, why 10 days? Because those 10 days will be far too hellacious for anyone associated with Yahweh to witness. Now, I know that there are some, and Dee might even be one of them, that thinks that the branch that is cut away is a secondary harvest during the year of 2033, year 6,000, yeah. Personally, I don't think anybody's going to do anything but just duck for cover during that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But the earth and that 10 days is going to be so bloody. It's not God killing, it's man killing man. It's,
right.
It's the corporeal manifestation of Satan being exceedingly belligerent against Yisrael and the world at war during that 10 days. And if it were not for Yahweh's intervention, it would be all over. On the planet would be annihilated. And so when Dode and Yahweh return on October 2nd, it is a Sunday evening, 6:22 p.m., year 6,000, Yah, 2033. The Teruah harvest beneficiaries of Yisrael and Yehudim, this multiple of seven, whether it's 7,000, 70,000, or 77,000, are going to accompany Yahweh. Mm-hmm. So we're all coming back at that time. You should note that in 33 CE, year 4,000 Yah, there was both a solar and a lunar eclipse. The solar eclipse was on the 1st of Abib in 33 CE, and the lunar eclipse was on Pesach in 33 CE. April or March 19th would be under the solar eclipse. That was Abib 1. And then the lunar eclipse was on Thursday, April 2nd, which is Pesach. In year 6,000, Yah, we have double solar and double lunar eclipses, exceedingly rare. To have four eclipses fall on four of the seven Moed Mikre. You have a solar eclipse that falls on the 1st of Abib in year 6,000, Yah, 2033, and a full lunar eclipse that falls on Passover in 2033. The solar eclipse is also occurs on Teruah, and a lunar eclipse on the first day of Sukkah. Double solar, double lunar eclipses on the most important days. Teruah in 2033 is a Shabbat. It's a Friday evening in 23 CE. It is the day of a solar eclipse, and the lunar eclipse takes place 2 weeks later, with the full moon between Sukkah and the first moon, the new moon of Sukkah, which is on the 15th day of that month.
Right.
So those are the signs in the sky that will accompany all of this. So that is your timeline. And, you know, there is something to be said about timelines that I'd like to discuss with you. So far, of those who have set dates, there has been the score is 0-0-0. Not a single person has been right.
Yeah, well.
So why now? Well, there's some profound differences now, and I want you to consider them. The first is that no one has ever associated the fulfillment of when this harvest of covenant family members will take place with the covenant, which is the most essential aspect of it, or with the Moed Mikre, which is even more essential than the covenant in this regard. Nor has anybody thought to associate Yahweh's return, because they don't even want to say his name, with an unfulfilled Moed Mikre. No one has ever associated Dod's fulfillment with the first three Mikre, as well as his fulfillment with the last three. No one's ever done that before. No one has ever established the timeline from the garden back to the garden. Year zero, out of the garden. Year 6,000 on Sukkah, camping out back in the garden. No one's ever done that before. No one's ever explained what each of the seven Moed Mikre contribute to God's covenant family. No one's ever explained what the five benefits are and the five conditions of the covenant and how they are, how they play out through the seven Moed Mikre. No one has ever created a timeline from being expelled in the garden to show what happened on Mount Moriah exactly 40 Yobel, which no one ever talks about, even understanding what the Yobel represents. But 40 Yobel, from that time, on Mount Moriah, with father and son, Abraham and Yishak, as the dress rehearsal for Pesach, exactly 40 Yobel thereafter, in exactly that same place. No one's ever done that before. No one's ever explained how in the exact middle of that time, the cornerstone was set for father and son to tell us about exactly how it was going to be fulfilled, telling us what he was going to endure on Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. Never been done before. No one has ever told you that the returning Messiah is the Son of God, the very King of Yisrael. Don't.
No, correct.
And so every date that we set is just an extrapolation of the profound truths that underlie them.
Exactly.
And so that's the difference. And no one has ever brought these truths to you that represents one of the most talked about individuals throughout the Torah and prophets. There are hundreds of references in the Torah and throughout the prophets of the specific job that we are doing, with an entire chapter of Yeshayah devoted to it. With Solomon's speech at the dedication of the covenant home on Mount Moriah in the middle of time, devoted to it. With a menu of these Moed Mikre, devoted to it. With it permeating the prophetic message, not only of Yeshayah, but of Zechariah, Malachi. And so this is the only occasion where that has occurred. And so there are always reasons to question. I think questioning is an intelligent thing to do. And clearly it is very difficult to try to mesh Yahweh's calendar with the various calendars that have existed over time, where the calendar we use now, which is a derivative of the Roman Catholic Church, trying to sync their Easter to the cycles that would have been appropriate for the celebration of Pesach. And yet never wanting it to fall on Pesach. But the Gregorian calendar is really a change to the Julian calendar, which was based on the great beast, Imperial Rome. And year, there wasn't even a year zero. They went from year one, which we would call BC, and I call BCE, to one CE without a year zero in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are lots of challenges, and even the days of the week, with this transition from the Julian to Gregorian. And of course, prior to Rome, you don't really have a Julian calendar. You're extrapolating back. But, you know, you can get dates in terms of CE and BCE that still are numbers that work within that frame. But making that association between the two is no easy task. And I've always said there's always the possibility for error. But when you recognize that 33 CE is the only year within seven either way where the Moed Mikre fall on the right dates, a Thursday night to celebrate Pesach, to serve as the Pesach lamb on a Friday, to have matzah, the ultimate Shabbat, to start on a Shabbat, and for Dod then to take our guilt with him into Sheol on the Shabbat, and then for firstborn children to be celebrated on the first day of the week. That only happens in 33. And when you look at what Dod himself as Gabriel told us about when these events were going to play out, you extrapolate the timeline that he gave us from what occurred in 444 BCE with the decree for Yehudim to leave Babylon and return to Yisrael, and you do the math, it is, he arrives 4 days before Pesach, when the Passover lamb is supposed to arrive, 4 days before Pesach in 33 CE. And so you put those things together and you say, what is 40 Yobel from that time? And what are the Moed Mikre to be fulfilled? And it delivers those dates. October 2nd for Pesach, it is Friday, September 23rd for Teruah. Sunday, October 2nd, 6:22 p.m. for Kippurim, and Sukkah, Friday, October 7th. Sukkah has to be a celebration of the Shabbat, and it falls on a Shabbat. That's how they were derived. And then if you look at the timelines that were provided throughout the Torah and prophets, you find out what happened in year zero, which is that's the time that Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden. And 1,000 years later, it's when Noach, who is the trustworthy guide that will show us the way back, was born. Noach is the trustworthy guide because of a very few simple ideas. He had walked away from the Nephilim, who were those who were overtly religious and political and violent. They were Hamas, according to Yahweh's description. They were into prostration and vicious. And Noach showed us the way to remove oneself from that and to be saved by Yahweh, which is separate yourself from the political and the religious community. Listen to Yahweh and act upon his instructions. Do what he says. Noach worked really hard at it. It wasn't all just handed to him. He was told, this is what you need to do. He did it. And he and his family were saved. That's what makes him a trustworthy guide. On year 2000 Yah, 1968 BCE, after a three-day walk, Abraham and his beloved son, Yishak, climbed Mount Moriah on Pesach and provided dress rehearsal for how the covenant family will be restored. They demonstrated their commitment to the covenant, that they understood the terms and conditions of the covenant, and provided this dress rehearsal for us to know that exactly 40 Yobel, 2,000 years after their walk up Mount Moriah, where Yahweh provided the lamb, that Father and Son would provide the lamb and fulfill Pesach on Mount Moriah, as they did with Yahweh and Dod. And you can look at the timeline. Indeed, you were instrumental in perverting the timeline on the Yada Yah side. It's a beautiful presentation. You use that the dates that Yahweh provided, and you know exactly what happened 1,000 years after that on year 3,000. Yeah, it's when the 89th Mizmor was given. It's when Solomon laid the cornerstone for the covenant home on Mount Moriah.
Yeah.
And 1,000 years after that is when Dod, with Yahweh's support, fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim.
The timeline on your site was put together by, and Jackie worked with me from the beginning on this project. I took your 2033 date and backtracked every epoch, every 1,000 years, and then I plugged in your theories, and then I did the chronology forward and to see how they lined up, and it took us, I want to say, 12 times of running that chronology through. I mean, we tried 70, 80 years with Adam, all different, you know, things, and I finally was able to go by placing Abraham correctly, backtrack the lineage up, so all of your theories were literally proven and worked out with the math of the chronology. So it was very rewarding work for Jackie and I. It was a lot of fun.
And there are subtleties within this where there Yahweh has years of triple harvest, for example, and how those years of triple harvest play into the time that the two witnesses are returned to Yisrael. And so there's expectations associated with that, that Yahweh put throughout his testimony. And the power of the Yobel and how everything plays out on these 40 iterations of Yobel years, which is 2,000 years. And the Yobel represents the top, that all slaves are freed. Yahweh is a liberator. That's why he went into Yisrael, to liberate his children. He is a liberator. He does not like religious or political oppression. All debts are forgiven. Well, for the covenant family, our guilt is forgiven because it no longer exists. Dod carried it all into Sheol to deposit it there, never to be seen again. And everyone returns to the land. And so we return to the ultimate promised land, which is not just Yisrael, which is turned back into the nature of the Garden of Eden, but into the entire earth becomes the promised land, as does Shamaim and the entire universe.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at this entirety, you realize that what God is offering us is to make us ever more like him. So we're going to go from being three-dimensional, being stuck in time, to being seven-dimensional, with each increase in dimension being an infinite increase in capability, such that things like, for example, you watch, I love to watch the science shows about, you know, how the universe works, that sort of thing. And the scientists that are honest with us will say, you know, they'll talk about hearing from extraterrestrials and this sort of things, that we're never going to hear from them. We're never going to see them. We're never going to go to another solar system. We're not even going to go to other planets within our solar system. Why? Because the distances are too great. It's just way, way, way beyond the capability for any material being to travel. And we can't even get to Mars because of the fact that the radiation, the cosmic radiation between here and there over that period of time would kill the astronauts.
Right.
The distances are too great. And so The only way to be able to enjoy this enormous universe with hundreds of billions of stars and hundreds of billions of galaxies spaced out from end to end, billion light years. The only way to be able to explore it and enjoy it is if we are transformed from matter to energy. Because as energy on a photon of light, you can be anywhere you want to be at any time you want to be there. And you'd say, wait a minute, well, you know, even at the speed of light, you know, the light we're seeing from the most distant stars took 14 billion years to get here. Well, not on that photon of light, it didn't. On the photon of light, it happened in a fraction of a second. Because speed is distance over time. But on a photon of light, time simply is. And so the faster you go, time slows to the point that it doesn't move. And therefore, you can travel the entire expanse of the universe in no time.
Right.
So it makes the universe available to us. And still, because of this interconnection between energy and matter, we can take a portion of our energy and transform it into a diminished form of matter and enjoy the kinds of things that are possible with a body for whenever we want. You find a planet that's around a star that looks interesting to you, you can go there and enjoy all the things that we can enjoy when we have a physical body, and then shed the body, return to energy, and go travel someplace else and do it forever. It's just such a great expansion of our capabilities and our intellect, the speed that we can process information and what we will come to know and learn and experience is just so much greater as we go from three dimensions stuck in time to four, five, six, and ultimately seven dimensions,
mm-hmm.
with each dimension being an infinite increase. So that's a lot to process, isn't it?
Boy, I guess.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, I received a letter from a person who I think would have any problem even if I mentioned the individual's name, because they sent the letter so openly to me. But I'm going to not mention the individual's name. The letter was really very thoughtfully written. I was quite impressed with it. And there's some questions on the letter that I think with the time we have left in our program, I'm going to review with you. It was written on the 14th of this month, just 3 days ago. Dear Craig, I'm glad that I was introduced to your website and YouTube channel. I have benefited from your hard work, and I thank our Father. You have opened my eyes. My introduction to you came through, and he mentions an individual that I don't know, and his YouTube channel. Again, he is an individual that I do not know. And it says, one of his recent videos, April of 2024, he mentioned reading some of your documents in questioning Paul. And that is a concern to me. The reason it's a concern to me is questioning Paul is the only series now that I have not rewritten, and I have not written Yosha out and Dode in. Mm-hmm. And that needs to be done, and it will be done over the next 6 months. But anyway, he read questioning Paul, and he says, I don't think this individual is convinced yet that Dode is the Messiah, but he has been anti-Paul for a long time. So he says, here are my thoughts. In order of importance to me, please take these items as feedback from one of your readers. You don't need to answer my questions. I will no doubt find the answers as I read more of your material. Number one, Dode is Messiah. He says, I agree with you that it could be the most important and valuable discovery in human history. Big statement. For me, as a former churchman, it is still an astounding hypothesis. The most important question that I must soon answer. I truly appreciate your work on this. Give me some time to process the Dode question. And for this individual, and I'm sharing this because I think this person brings up questions that a lot of people are going to share, which is the reason he wrote me the letter.
Mm-hmm.
And why I think it's helpful for us to go through it. I did not share the realization that Dode was not only the Messiah and Son of God, and that Dode was not only the person that was coming back, returning with Yahweh on Yom Kippurim, and to be the King of Kings for all eternity. Well, I've known that and shared that for a long time. I did not share the realization that Dode was the Pisakael, the Zeroa, until about, what, 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a lot. Because I had this mindset that said, no, can't be. God would never allow his son to endure such a thing. And so I came up with this contraption that turned out to be very accurate in the sense of a Yosha that was Yahweh projecting his soul as a avatar, if you will, to fulfill Pesach and Matzah. And it was the names, right? Yahweh saves. Yahweh delivers. He just did it through Dode's soul. And this recognition that Dode volunteered for this mission. And in fact, Dode looked at this mission and said, this is something I must do. This is something that is not only in Yisrael's interest, it is in my interest. This is something that is right with my father, and it's right for the son. And I finally decided to come out on this issue when dealing with what we've been reading these past few weeks on the Hebrew moods, on how Dode wrote of volition in both first and second person, where he would express this was his choice, his desire, in the cohortative mood, expressing first-person volition, and about Yahweh's choice, his decision. And he wrote about this such that it was an expression of both first and second person volition, how he had chosen and Yahweh had wanted him to make this decision to fulfill Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, becoming the Pesach El, providing redemption for every covenant member. And I remember reading this and coming to the conclusion that there really is, this is so profound. And it is so clear that he volunteered to do this. And then once you understand why he would do it, you know, that so much was asked of Dode, you know, so much was required of Dode. This is a man who gave so much of himself and so much passion, so much intellect, wrote so many of the Mizmor Psalms, so many of the Mashal Proverbs, fought 66 battles on behalf of Yisrael. And yet, he had his moments where he made some really dunderhead decisions. And he looked, I'm certain, at Moshe, as I have looked at Moshe. And when you study Moshe's character from the time that he stands up on behalf of the Hebrew that was being beaten by the taskmaster and risks his life to spare that individual, and then you witness what the Hebrews did to him. And then when Yahweh asked him to go back, although he's reluctant, he says, all right, I'll go back. And then to walk for 40 years Israel through the wilderness where they're so embittered and so ungrateful and so unappreciative. And not only to deliver the Torah as Yahweh had shared it with him, but the Bodim is his contribution. It's him saying, this is what I understand. This is what's important. This is what you need to know. That there's nobody in human history that had the character of Moshe. The man did everything right. It's just the most exemplary character of all people in human history. And Dode, no doubt, knew that because he wrote his 119th Mizmor on how to observe the Torah. It's one of the greatest pieces of literature ever written. And he would have come to the realization that the children of Yisrael were unmanageable, even with a person who got all of his instructions directly from Yahweh, who was supported completely by Yahweh, out in the open, defeating all of Israel's enemies right out in the open. And yet, they were embittered towards him. And Dode is saying, how in the heck then am I supposed to manage these people for all eternity? And then it dawned on him. Exactly what Yahweh was talking about with Abraham and Yitzhak on Mount Moriah. Don't take the life of your son, your only son, whom you love. Dode is the only person that Yahweh refers to as a son. He calls him my firstborn. His very name means beloved. And at that moment, Dode realized this is the way. This is the right thing to do. And by doing this very thing, I forever put myself in a position where a covenant family is going to listen to what I have to say. They are going to respect my leadership because everybody is there because of what Dode did. We all benefit from his sacrifice. 2 days, and he gains an eternity of respect. It was the natural decision to make. I'm quite certain he's the only person with the character, the courage to make it, but he did.
Yeah.
And so there's so much about Dode. And, you know, while I would say, is there the possibility that we could be wrong a year or two with all of the integrating calendars and the like? I guess it's possible. Boy, the information is so overwhelming that we've got this one right. I'm not concerned. But as it relates to Dode, serving as the Pesach El, being the Son of God to the returning Messiah, zero chance that that's wrong. That is the greatest discovery in human history. His next point was, boy, that's a lot of pages. How will I ever read your 30 books? And soon it'll be 35 books. You know, it's 20,000 pages, right? Will I live long enough? Many days I read 50 to 100 pages in one of your books. As I read, I refer to my copy of the scriptures. That's a book that I also had. And a Hebrew interlinear at Bible Hub. I use that too. I like the interlinear there. And he says, you know, it's a good workout. He says, my reading rate is 3 to 15 pages, 15 minutes a page, which tells me this is a thinking man. Because you can read a page in 1 minute, but you can't process it in 1 minute. You can't fact check it in 1 minute. You can't make the connections to understand what you're being told in 1 minute,
right.
But you can in 3 to 15 minutes, depending on how much information is on that page. This is a thinking man.
Yeah.
So as I'm answering these questions, I can tell you, I like this guy. I can relate to this guy. That is the pace
Howard.
That is appropriate. But he's saying, you know, how am I ever going to get through it all? You know, So I've read six of your books, he says. I've read An Introduction to God, Volume 1, 2, and 3. I've read Yada Yao, Volume 4. I've read Coming Home, he says. I'm currently reading Volume 1. Babel, Volume 1. Questioning Paul, Volume 1. That's a lot. Certainly enough to understand the five conditions and the five benefits of the covenant, which he clearly understands in the role of the Moed Mikre and our relationship with Yahweh. Next point is Dead Sea Scrolls. So the Dead Sea Scrolls started out badly, which is really true. And it's beginning to turn around. As a boy, I heard of the news of the Dead Sea Scrolls being discovered. And then I heard that the scholars had read the scrolls and concluded that there's nothing new, nothing that significantly differs from our Bible. Go back to sleep. It's a crime that a committee essentially hid the Dead Sea Scrolls from the world for 50 years, which is what they did. In fact, the timing of writing the Yada Yahweh series wasn't possible even 3 years before I started. The publication of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the time I began coincided. The finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls coincided with my birth. And the publication coincided with my meeting with Yahweh, where he said, I want you to do this for me and for my people. He says, so for the following 30 years, Bible publishers pretended that the Dead Sea Scrolls don't exist. No need to update our translations. He calls that appalling, and I agree with him. Dead Sea Scrolls version is point four. Will you publish your amplified version of the Dead Sea Scrolls as a standalone book? No. I've talked about this a lot, and it's brought up places in the Torah. I'm incapable of doing it. It's not how my mind works. It's not the job that I was given. The job that I was given and the way that my mind works is to translate statements from Yahweh's Torah and prophets and to make the connections necessary to form insights and conclusions that I can share that help bring Yahweh and his people together. That's who I am. That's what I do. That's all I'm ever going to do. Now, I can tell you because of the website and what David has done on the website where we have a lookup that if you want to read just translations, you can do so. Go to the website, and you can start at Barashith, and he'll have everything that I have written, every place that that a passage in Barashith is presented, and you click on it, it comes right up on your browser, and you can read right away. It's a very efficient way to do it. It's beautifully done, and it has both the amplified and the non-amplified summary versions of everything. And boy, we can look. I mean, we have really done an amazing job in terms of the amount of amplified translations of the Torah and prophets. So it exists in that format for you to read. We're about ready to end the broadcast portion of this Shabbat program for this evening. We'll continue on, though, because of the archives and the fact that most of our listeners are on the phone. They can continue to hear us, and 99% of our listeners are from the YouTube channels and from the social media outreach and just from archives of this program. So that's the answer, is there is a Dead Sea Scrolls version. And it's found through the index on the site. The next point is dates and years. He says, a 1969 Chicago hit song posed a good question. Does anybody really know what time it is? They asked, does anybody really know? Does anybody really care? Great song. Great questions. Do we really know what year this is? He asks. Really? Who can demonstrate that there has been an accurate accounting of years since 4000 BCE, since 33 CE. How confident are you about the years and the dates? Throughout history, there hasn't been accounts of a king or a pope adding days, subtracting days, changing calendars, and changing years. Hey, just haven't there been? Yes, there have been. And if you've written on this topic, I've not read it yet. I actually have written a lot on this particular topic. There really isn't a problem with years. Dee, I think you're going from 1968 BCE with Dode and Yishak on Mount Moria, very easily identified that date. And it's very
yes.
easy to go from that date forward 40 Yobel to 33 CE, and you also come on 33 CE through the prophecies that the Messiah himself, Gabriel,
right.
Provided in the book of Daniel. And so you come upon that both through the chronologies to get to year 2000 Yah to year 4000 Yah in 33 CE. It's really a very straightforward approach and a double affirmation of that being accurate. There is no chance that we have lost a full year from 33
no.
CE to the present time. The calendar was adjusted from the Julian to the Gregorian, but those dates have no effect on Yahweh's setting of the time of the Moed Mikre, because his setting of the time of the Moed Mikre began with Abib being the new moon closest to the time that barley would be green in the kernel, so it's just emerging, and then everything starts from that point during those particular years. And in essence, that turns out to be the new moon that's closest to the vernal equinox. Barley now is a very minor crop in Israel. It's mostly planted in the very, very southern part of Israel. And some years, you know, you do have a later barley harvest. This year happened to be one, which is why a number of people celebrated Pesach a month later than we did this year. I celebrated it on the 14 days from the new moon, closest mm-hmm. to the vernal equinox. Others celebrated a month later, which was the Hebkal celebration. The Hebkal, mm-hmm. though, moved their dates because they didn't want them to coincide with Easter week. But it coincided with a late barley harvest, so, you know, it works. But since Yahweh's dates are established based upon a solar lunar calendar and adjusting the time of the time of the first month based upon the timing of barley being Abib, we really don't have a problem with the change from the Gregorian to the from the Julian to the Gregorian calendar. So I don't think that's a problem at all. Yeah, I mean, again, I'm very open, and I've always said taking Yahweh's calendar and trying to apply it to the human timepiece that is so fraught with religion and politics is always perilous. But I think between what you've done and the timeline and what I've done in terms of the explanation of what these dates represent, I think we're pretty solid on that. Then he writes date setting.
I'd like to explain something about that if I have just 2 minutes. There are NASA calculators that have counted the moon phases, the solar path of the sun year after year, going back thousands of years, and those tools are available completely free. And Jackie and I actually looked at them, and you can compare and see how much time is lost over a given span. The Jews have a 19-year Metonic cycle after, and you've had a disclaimer about that. It's up on the timeline. Their Metonic cycle is wrong. But the moon, the sun, they collect all the time. They catch up every decade or so, roughly. Mm-hmm. It's very precise math. But the facts are is that no time whatsoever has been lost, and we actually have tools in our time that can prove that. So whether or not the calendar years change, they can relabel it to whatever they'd like, change the numbers, change the months around. You know, the months aren't even
yeah.
labeled for the correct month in the Roman calendar
yeah.
for
yeah.
The number
yeah.
of months. It's ridiculous. But the point is, no matter how much they try to confuse it, the calendar that's actually confused is the Jewish calendar, which throws
yeah.
Jews off 206 years.
Oh,
so,
yeah. But that's yeah, that's because of Maimonides' fascination
thing.
With the number 19, which is a derivative
mm-hmm.
from all of his affinity for Islam. And
right.
His basis was insane. And
right.
it had nothing to do with the genealogies that are presented in the Torah. And it's a shame that Jews have been misled by Maimonides. In fact, everything Maimonides wrote, he is one of the most disastrous people for Jews in the history
Absolutely.
Of the race. So he goes on to say, he says, the batting average for date setters of the future prophetic events is a goose egg, 000. I fear that your second October 33 date is wrong due to calendar uncertainties and our year number. In other words, this might not be 2024, but another year. Would you write an article providing your derivation of your data? I have, and soon I'm going to write an entire volume on it. But what I think you're missing, and this is a very smart man, but what you're missing is 2024, 2025 mean nothing. 2026 means nothing. 2033 means nothing. What we care about is year zero, Yah. Adam and Chawa being booted out of the garden. Year 2000 Yah, 40 Yobel from then, which is 2,000 years. Year 2000 Yah, which is Abraham and Yishak going to Mount Moriah as the dress rehearsal for the covenant, as the way to rectify that separation from God that was caused in the garden, so that we can all return via the covenant and all of its benefits and promises, and that 40 Yobel from that time is 33 CE. Now, 33 is meaningless. It's year 4,000 Yah. And 2033 is meaningless. It's year 6,000 Yah. And so we're doing with this calendar, the Gregorian calendar, is telling you when Yom Kippurim and Teruah will be fulfilled in year 6,000 Yah. Because if I tell you that Yah was returning on Kippurim with Dod in year 6,000 Yah, and that he's going to harvest the remnant of Yisrael and Yehuda on Teruah in year 6,000 Yah, and that 7 years prior to that, he's going to harvest the covenant family on Shabuah, you're not going to know when that's going to occur unless we were to apply the dates in years Yah and days Yah to how they intersect with our calendar. So I don't really care if this year is 2024 or when 2033 occurs. All we're doing is we're taking year 3,000 or 6,000 Yah from what we learned about year 4,000 Yah, from what we learned about year 2,000 Yah,
right.
and applying Yahweh's dates to our calendar so that our listeners and readers know when these events are going to transpire.
And it's all based on Shemitah and Yobel cycles. And Israel was and Yehuda were exiled for not letting the land rest on Shemitah years. So even more principled is that you can't fake every 7 years being counted, every 50th year being counted over and over for 120 times to get to 6,000.
Right.
There's no room, no margin to lose, no error, and then matching it all to archaeological records as well as what Yahweh has revealed, it's as close to accurate as we'll ever get with the margin of human error that we have.
Yeah. Then the next point is Babylonian systems. Would you consider in your list of Babylonian systems that we leave behind, instead of politics, use government? And I've thought about that a lot. You know, I use politics and religion as opposed to government and religion, although sometimes I will use government. human government is a political system, whether it's a fascist or communist or socialist system. The systems of government are political. I know a lot of people love politics, and they don't like me chastising political parties, but the fact is that God's not into politics, doesn't want us to be political. And since most of us aren't involved in government, the thing that distracts us from Yahweh is our political allegiances. And we trust and define ourselves by our political allegiances. So politics actually works better as describing the things that we as a covenant family must need to disassociate with, because most of us are already disassociated from government. He doesn't, this particular thing, fellow doesn't like me to speak about conspiracies, and he preferred to say, you know, pursuit of pleasures and entertainment and obsession with sports and that sort of thing, because personally I don't think that pursuit of pleasure or entertainment or obsession with sports are bad things. I have to look at sports as a way to rest my mind at the end of the day. You know, I will look at the PGA Championship because I'm fascinated by it. And I know that Yahweh has nothing against pleasure. So I do think that conspiracies, he uses the term, he really despises conspiracies because they are these giant sinkholes to which credibility is lost. And so many of the conspiracies boil down to blaming Jews. So he hates them. He hates human government schemes. And politics is how most people engage in them, and of course, religion. So that's the only place here we are going to disagree. The truth, he says, what happened to the truth of the Messiah in the first century CE? Apparently, it went seriously sideways. How did the truth become suppressed so quickly? Who were the guilty parties? No doubt Paul was in the middle of that. How did Dode become marginalized and Yosha, Jesus, become promoted? Prior to reading your books, I thought that we should all emulate the Ebonites. Maybe you've written about this, but I haven't read it yet. I do speak a lot about the Ebonites and the legacy they left of a Hebrew text of what's called the Sermon on the Mount and also of the Olivet Discourse. It's the only part of the book of Matthew that is probably reasonably accurate. It's the only part of Matthew that wasn't plagiarized from Mark and Luke. And it was plagiarized from the text of the Ebonite Hebrew text. Unfortunately, we've lost what they've written. All we have it is filtered through now the book of Matthew. What I think occurred largely is that Dode had no interest in disciples. He had no interest in tooting his horn. He had already said what he was going to do and why he was going to do it. No one wrote more clearly or more voluminously than did Dode. The prophecies provided by Dode are overwhelming. He said exactly what he was going to do, when he was going to do it, and how it would to transpire. So there wasn't any need to write anything more. It's far more credible to say what you're going to do 1,000 years before you do it and then do it. And that's what happened. He wasn't there to provide another writing. You know, Yahweh was very clear. He said, you know, in fact, Dode was very clear. It was him that said there'll be no more prophetic revelation. The prophets communicated over exactly 1,000 years from 1447 BCE with the revelation of the Torah to Malachi in 447. It's 1,000 years done. There are no more prophets. All you have left now is the interpretation, the understanding of what was conveyed by the prophets, which we began here 22 years ago and are going to continue right to the very end. Dode was essential in providing exactly what was going to happen. And everyone among his people should have known. They had 1,000 years to process what Dode had written about Pesach. They had 1,447 years, actually 1,450 years by the time we roll around to 33 CE to process what the Torah predicted was going to occur. They knew that that year 4,000 Yah was going to be special. They knew that Yah was going to fulfill Pesach in this way. And Dode explained it all. But unfortunately, Yehudim have been irascible. They wrote God out of their testimony. They preferred their Jerusalem and Babylonian Talmud. They replace what God said and fixate on their own writings. And they denied that God could promise them. They denied that Joseph was the Messiah. They denied that Pesach has been fulfilled in this way. They still celebrate it as an event that happened way back in Egypt, as opposed to its fulfillment, and they completely ignore Matzah, which is actually the more important date, and are clueless as to what happened on Bukurim. So Jews missed it because they don't understand Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, because they don't like, actually, rabbinical Judaism doesn't like Dode. Renamed him David. They don't like him, and they're jealous of him. They don't like the fact that God's claiming that he has a son. They don't like that covenant implication. They don't like the idea that he is the king. They don't like the idea that he was anointed 3 times. They don't like any of it. And so it's almost like they're in competition with him. So they couldn't.
I'm sure.
They just didn't process it. So they completely missed it. And yet, because this enormous event happened, that Dode came as the Messiah and the Son of God to fulfill Pesach and Matzah and Bukurim, it was obvious that something extraordinary happened. And so filling in that void, a demon-possessed man, Paul, and Peter, who was likely demon-possessed as well, wrote this myth of Iesus Christus. And came up with this myth of how it was fulfilled, and essentially wrote the story as if it was Odysseus and Dionysus, and nothing but fables and anti-Jewish. I mean, it was just horrible what they wrote, and it's so obviously untrue. And then doubling down, the rabbis, rather than saying, "No, wait a minute," it's Dode that's the Messiah. No, it's Dode that we're told is the Zeruah, the Passover lamb. No, it's Dode that's the Son of God. You can't have this mythical guy that comes and does. No, rather than to battle off this myth of Christianity, the rabbis doubled down by coming up with their own false Messiah, Bar Kokhba. And that's how Akiva started rabbinical Judaism. That's how it happened.
Yep.
And then the religions got entrenched, and people believed them, and the truth was ignored. And that's why Dode, when we went through these Mizmor, is so pissed off. He says, "I've done all this for you, and you give me no respect."
Right.
What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
So that is the answer to your question. He says, write some articles, maybe 500 to 4,000 words in length, providing answers to frequently asked questions. Well, obviously, I'm helping you out with some frequently asked questions here, but I have written a lot of articles. The most recent is the article on At War with Religion. It's the second or third chapter of Goddamn Religion, Snake, Volume 1, is an open letter to Israel. And he says, how about shorter books too? People are laughing. But actually, I've written a lot of short books. They're called chapters.
Yeah.
And, you know, the, if you read Why You, Why Me, it's a full-length book as a chapter.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
So there are lots of short books. They just happen to be chapters in this case. But knowing takes time. There's a lot to know. I mean, it's, you know, we would not have come to the conclusion that Dodd volunteered to be the Pesach El, that he was the Zeruah, the Passover lamb, that he is the Messiah, that he is the Son of God, that he is the King of Kings, that he fulfilled the first three Mikra, and he's coming back to fulfill the last. We would not know that or our role in conveying this to Yisrael had we not been thorough in our investigation. And because you really need to know before you can make the connections to understand. And the books are long because there's a lot to know, and then once you know it, you have to make the proper connections to understand, which is where the real power and value is in the Word of
God. The Torah, Prophets, and Psalms are pretty lengthy on their own, and then you're discussing them and exposing all the corruption surrounding them. That's not something you can do in a little pamphlet.
No. It's and Yahweh has set it up this way. And
yes.
And this person is not a complainer because, listen, they've written, read six books and is devoting a lot of time to each page of each book. So this is the person that is really committed to the process because Yahweh doesn't want to make it easy. He doesn't want you to give you a little cheat sheet and you say, okay, you read this pamphlet and if you agree to these terms, you're in. Because otherwise, what you'd have is eternity filled with people that really don't give a hoot. You mean they, you know, I don't want to have my time interrupted. I don't like this idea of devoting that much time to learning. That's not who Yahweh wants to spend eternity with. He wants like-minded people who love to learn. And then once they've learned, to make the connections to understand and then have a passion to share. That's who he wants to spend eternity with. And this is a filtering mechanism for that process. He went on to say the five conditions. He said, I really love your conditions, your presentation of the five conditions of the covenant. Very succinct and helpful. The five conditions show what Yah expects of us really quite simply. You could make that one of your articles. I have one of the shortest books that I have ever written is the one called Family. It's volume 3 of the Yada Yah series, and it is the covenant. I think it's only like 300 pages or something. So it is the shortest book that I have written of all of the books. One of the things he does say, and I want to emphasize this, is says yadayahweh.com is handsome. It's clean. It's responsive, and it prevents very well. And Brave, which is one of the browsers. I happen to use Brave. I think it's a very, very good browser. And Firefox, I also use Firefox. The thing that about the Yada Yah site is that it works across all of the browsers. The newer ones like Brave, the older ones like Firefox, Google, it works. Chrome, I should say, as part of that series, but it works beautifully in Chrome. It works beautifully in Firefox. It works across all of those, but it also works across platforms. I read many nights on my phone. The site is easily searched and easily read on a smartphone. It's easily presentable and read on a tablet. It reads beautifully on a laptop. I spend most of my time on the site on a full desktop with a wide screen. It scales beautifully through all of those, no matter what browser we're using. And the site is so intuitive with the books on the shelf and the ways to search for them and the most recent addition that David has made, so that underneath the books actually embedded within the shelf itself, you can go to the things that are each of the series of books, and it takes you right to them and shades them for you. That site is so beautifully done with the resources
cool.
And the podcasts and the books and the index. It is really it is a marvelous website, and I'm very, very proud of it. And you know, and my books are presented there, but it's David that has created it, and I agree that it's handsome, it's clean, it's responsive, and it presents very well. Calendar says your treatment of the calendar, the appointed times, invitations is simple, generous, and fair. Too many people divide on the subject. I get a headache twice a year, spring and fall, every time, and rethink the calendar. Thanks to you, the calendar will be less controversial for some of us. I think that is something that that my friend Joe did a long time ago. I said, let's create a calendar that is for the thinking person. Rather than us setting dates, let's give people the opportunity to think through when the Moed Mikre are going to be celebrated. And we've carried that through all the way to the end, where we present the information so that you can ascertain when the first of Abib is, and therefore when you're going to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, Teruah on the seventh month, and then again for Kippurim and Sukkah. And so I agree. I think the calendar is very, very well presented, and the timeline also. He has some issues on the age of the Earth and physicists and the like. It's not worth the argument. Other than I would say the reason I happen to like the timing that scientists have had when they look at the microwave radiation from the Big Bang is that if you divide the modality that we know about the stretching of time from the cosmic microwave radiation, which is 10 to the 12th power, by the 14 billion years, you end up with six 24-hour days. And I just think that is just so jaw-dropping. It's so beautiful that I really like it. And I do think that when we talk about how old the universe is, it's relative. You know, the Earth didn't even exist, but 5 billion of the 14 billion years. And so Earth days were irrelevant for most of that time. So it really is is understanding relativity and how time has proceeded and how 14 billion years is just our time looking back using the rotation of the orbit of the Earth around the sun. But that's not Yahweh's perspective, and he's the creator telling us this story. In his story, we're still in the sixth day, about ready to celebrate the seventh. And that is all because time is relative, and we can do the math to correlate his perception of time to our own. Anyway, that's the points of this gentleman. I thought it was a beautifully written letter.
Yeah.
I hope this was helpful. I hope he listens to this program. I don't know if he does or not, or just reads the books. But I think we've had a useful time going through it. So that brings us to the end of the program. Blog Talk Radio is going to say good night in a matter of seconds. So thank you very much for listening. And may
thank you
all have a wonderful Shabbat. Good night.
Hi, guys.
Night.
Mom, why is this movie download taking so long?
The internet's slower because our network gives cell phone users priority during the busiest hours.
Why?
Because we have T-Mobile 5G home internet.
Why?
Because your dad didn't listen when I said to choose Cox Internet.
Why?
Why switch to T-Mobile 5G home internet when you can have faster, more reliable download speeds during peak hours with Cox Internet? Visit cox.com/5G home today. T-Mobile prioritizes certain T-Mobile phone users over home internet users during times of congestion.
This morning in North Carolina, wheels are spinning. Determination is winning. A passion is now a thriving business, and it shows no signs of slowing down. How? The power of a conversation, like the one Clint Spiegel had with First Horizon Bank about starting a bike wheel manufacturing facility in Asheville. Now it's not just talk, it's rubber meets road. First Horizon Bank, let's find a way. Go to firsthorizon.com/Clint. First Horizon Bank, member FDIC.